All right, ladies and gentlemen, whatever the intro I said, welcome back. And I have with me here Angela Plowhead, and she is running for Congress. Now, I know it is a big step up from last episode where I brought you someone who was running for House District 22, but what can I say? Oregon politics, you gotta get around sometimes. Angela, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, David.
So, I mean, the question is, well, before we get into everything, I want to say that I was very impressed by your performance at Dorchester.
Oh, thank you.
And I left there knowing more about you as a person than a candidate, which I think is very important. Because it wasn't a debate, really. I felt like it was more of a panel. I don't know if you come off with the same impression, but I came off knowing more about you as a person and that rather than a candidate. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, so most of what we've had so far have been forums versus debates. They're oftentimes called debates, but there's no real debating happening. I think that'll probably happen after the primary once we get into the general.
I look forward to that because for those of you who don't know, this is a new district done by redistricting. So it's very much an open, a very much over winner takes all, basically, is the way that I look at it.
Yeah, so this is the sixth congressional district was the seat that was created by the census. And so when our five districts were redistricted into six, this one was created mostly in the valley. And so it runs from Marion County, so the very edge of Marion County. It goes east past I-5. So we have Jefferson, Turner, Almsville in there in the lower part of it. And then it goes all the way up through Woodburn in Marion County and Hubbard. And then we've got all of Yamhill, Polk, part of Clackamas. So we have Aurora and Wilsonville and just a very tiny bit of Lake Oswego. And then it goes into Washington County. And so we have Tiger, Tualatin, and a part of Beaverton.
That's massive. Now, having looked at the congressional map, it's weird in the way that they drew it. I think, anyways, it's a very bizarre shape.
Yeah, and mine's the most normal, actually, of all of the districts. Yeah.
So, I know that you we spent a little bit of time at Dorchester, getting to know you as a person. Tell me, just give me a quick summary about yourself.
Sure. So I started my career in the Air Force. I was an intelligence analyst. Met my husband there. He grew up here in Oregon. He grew up in Albany. And so when we married in the Air Force and got out, he wanted to come home. So that's what we did. We came back here to Oregon. I went to graduate school at George Fox to get my doctorate in clinical psychology. I still had a heart for veterans, so really focused all of my training towards that. And worked in VA for about 12 years and ended up leaving VA, opened a private practice, and have been a small business owner since that time. That also gave me an opportunity to really kind of follow some of my passions of advocacy. And so I've been an advocate for seniors and people with disabilities since then. So since 2014, first up in Clackamas, which is where we lived at the time in Oregon City. And then we moved to Salem. And so I've done that here in Salem at Northwest Senior and Disability Services through the Senior Advisory Council. And so done lots of kind of policy work, budgeting work, and lots of advocacy at the legislature, both the local legislature here in the state and also federal around those kinds of issues. And so lots of federal experience, lots of understanding how the government works. And you know, just a lot of lived experience related to the issues that are really problematic today.
And I'd like to say thank you for your service, first and foremost, before we get too far into it. But speaking on your lobbying experience, can you say what did you learn from your time, not only in Salem, but lobbying to the federal government?
You know, what I learned was that a lot of our legislators are really, they're bent on a mission. versus wanting to know what their constituents want. And that I found really problematic. You know, oftentimes when you go to see a legislator, you get maybe 15 minutes to talk to them about whatever it is that you're there to talk to them about, if you get to speak with them at all. And so they're very disconnected oftentimes from the people they serve. And, you know, I have a heart of service, and that to me doesn't sit well. So that would definitely be something that I'll focus on in Congress, is to make sure that when my constituents come to see me, that they actually get to see me. And, you know, when there's an issue happening for them, that they have a personal connection, and know that there is someone there in the federal government that cares about them and their issues. They're not going to get form letters that have absolutely nothing to do with what they've said.
Right. You get the generic letters, and then at the very end of the last paragraph, it'll be, thank you for submitting. I look forward to addressing this in Congress. At one point or another, we've all gotten those letters, and it doesn't feel generic enough. It feels generic. It doesn't feel authentic enough. Mm-hmm. As to having, you know, time with a congressman or congresswoman on a particular issue. And I feel like it only gets more irritating when you lobby and you have these limitations, and they, you know, they only limit themselves to how much time they're available to you.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, part of what I've seen happen is that, you know, just like with OHA, you know, there were, 600 and something people that wanted to testify, and it went on for, or maybe it was 300 something. It went on for 6 hours or something like that. And almost every single person said, you know, no, we don't want the mask. We're tired of the mandates. You need to do away with them. And we don't want these rules to be permanent, but yet they did it anyway. So, you know, there's a real break right there in the power structure of our federal government, when it's we the people that are supposed to be governing, and we have representatives who are supposed to represent us. And so when you have an overwhelming response from your electorate, and they're telling you that they don't want something or that they do want something, I feel like the legislators or the whoever the authority is there needs to listen. And right now we don't really have that much of a representative government when it comes to that. You know, we get Absolutely. To elect them, but then they go and do whatever they want. And that's not okay.
Absolutely. It feels that today, especially on the federal level, it seems that we are governed by ideology. And that is something that we've seen the effects of that for 2 years, of what ideology will do instead of substantive good policy.
Right.
On that, while we're talking about a dysfunctional government, mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm pretty sure you've heard that the Biden administration has now instituted its own disinformation board.
Right.
Which, as Orwellian as you get, I mean, that's pretty much nail on the head.
Censorship. Yeah, that is absolutely censorship. Yeah.
Absolutely. And this coming off of Elon Musk buying Twitter. So in your eyes, do you believe that because the federal government can establish this, what we call a ministry of truth here, and because they lost another avenue mm-hmm. to kind of control the narrative, do you think that that's a very strong indication that the federal government has become too powerful?
Yeah, you know, I started seeing this happen, and really it started before this, but where I really started to see it happen was with the Patriot Act, where we started to give more power over to the executive branch and remove it from Congress. And so, you know, that really started a trend of relinquishing power, the power structure that really kept our Constitution strong and kept our country moving forward, where we had checks and balances. And now it's really lopsided, and we have to return some of that power back to Congress, where they can do something about it when we have a president that's kind of going rogue and doing things that, you know, like this president has done, you know, giving over intelligence information to telling the American people that they have given over our intelligence to our enemies, people that have stated they're our enemies and want to destroy us. When we see a president that has more than once told us that he is working with big tech and with social media giants to censor American voices. And that is absolutely in contrast to what our Constitution gives us the right to do. And so we need to have the ability to make a change in that. And right now we need enough Congress people that are going to actually carry that forward because they do have the power. They can do something about that.
I can only imagine the amount of rage that must have that you must have had when you, as a former intelligence officer, knowing that Biden gave our intelligence of Russia's attack to the Chinese, and Chinese went and then turned and gave it to Russia.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
It really is absurd and inexcusable, really. And that's treason. And that's the definition of treason. I just want to make one correction. I wasn't an intelligence officer. I was intelligence analyst. So I was enlisted. I wasn't an officer.
Right. I forget that it's different in the military world as it's the civilian.
Yeah,
I apologize.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
Sorry, just to make
so. Yeah. But you're absolutely right. So these are the things that our government has been engaging in that are really endangering our military members. They're endangering our mission and the safety of American interest. And so, you know, we need to rein a lot of that in, rein this president in. From engaging in these kinds of acts, it's not okay at all.
Right. Because had the situation been flipped, then Congress would have immediately not acquiesced its power to Trump, and would have immediately we would have been in the middle of impeachment hearings at the moment.
Oh right. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
But because Biden does it, Congress willingly acquiesces its power to the executive. And if we've learned anything from American history and American politics, is when the legislature acquiesces its power to the executive, it is very difficult to get that power back. And we saw that with the use of military force, with Obama, with, I believe it was Lebanon. So It's something that we need. Not only we need people in Congress to kind of have that idea that the federal government has gone without its scope, has gone way beyond its scope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, not only has the federal government gone beyond its scope, but different branches of the government have gone beyond their scope. And I was glad to see, you know, this ruling from, even though it was leaked and it shouldn't have been, from the Supreme Court, that they're walking back some issues that really belong to the states. You know, those are states' rights issues, and they never should have been in the federal government. And when you look back at position papers of different constitutional attorneys that have an expertise in this matter, you know, they were saying a long time ago that Roe v. Wade never should have happened, that it wasn't constitutional, and if it were ever challenged, then it very well could be overturned. And, you know, so I think the justices have done exactly what they should have done by overturning this, and I was glad to see that, you know, we're in a position now where we actually have constitutionalists that are in the Supreme Court that are not going to be trying to create legislation from the bench. That's not their role.
Right. And anybody who has read Roe v. Wade can tell you that it is severely unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And we've known this for a while. It was only a matter of time before the Supreme Court decided to act, which is good. But now you start to hear Democrats in the House and Senate saying, okay, well, maybe we can't get it on the Supreme Court, but we'll codify it into federal law. What do you have to say to Democrats who want to federalize it because they did not get a win in the Supreme Court?
You know, I would say you need to be careful with what you wish for, right? So if you're going to start federalizing things that really are a state's issues, then you're going to, and maybe this is the one thing that you like, but you don't want that to happen when it's something you don't like, right? And so just because it fits your narrative now doesn't mean it's going to fit your narrative 4 years from now or 2 years from now when there's a different Congress. So, you know, that it's the same kind of issue like when they start talking about the filibuster. So yeah, you want to get rid of the filibuster now because you don't have the numbers, but yet when it's you that's in the minority, then you want to have the filibuster. So you know, I think we need to be looking long-term at what the consequences are of what we're doing. And, you know, not only was Roe v. Wade unconstitutional, but, you know, 48% of all women that have abortions are in what's considered a domestic issue, which means domestic violence or human trafficking. And so if we want to address the issues of abortion, you know, we can't say that we're being compassionate and we're giving people a choice when almost half of the people that engage in abortions are people that are doing it by coercion. And what we know about when someone has an abortion and they've been coerced into it is that they have worse mental health outcomes. So, you know, it's not compassionate. And it's not a choice for the woman when she's being coerced into doing it and then being forced to go back out and get pregnant again and then have to go through another medical procedure that endangers her life or her future ability to have children. And so, you know, those are, I think, really poor arguments that have been used to talk about it being an empowerment for women when you have almost half of the women that have abortions that are doing it because someone is forcing them. Or they're in a situation that's forcing this.
Right. And it's almost become it's become more of a ideological issue than it really has become looking at individual situations and being and thinking, how can we best address this? Because right. you can see that the meltdown over the establishment media over the last 24 hours, you could see mm-hmm. how entrenched it is into ideology. And yes. So we're far beyond trying to find a very comprehensive solution.
Right. Yeah, and we know the issues that lead women to have abortions. You know, it's things like poverty, it's things like abuse. So why don't we help that? Why don't we address those issues instead of and helping them to find ways out of that, helping them to find ways out of being trafficked, instead of doing things like trying to couch it as this is their choice and it's part of empowerment. Well, you're kind of speaking out of both sides of your mouth when you're pushing something that actually harms half the women that do it. And on the other side, you're also saying, well, we also need to have trans people in women's sports that take away women's opportunities for higher education, because it takes away things like scholarships and their ability to actually get championships. And so we've watched that play out this past swim season, right? I think it was the Summer Olympics where they had the Australian weightlifter that was a trans person. And so, you know, in women's sports, so you take these biological men that were failing, you know, they weren't able to cut it in men's sports. So they decide that they're going to compete in women's sports. And of course they're winning because physiologically they have an advantage. And so you can't speak out of both sides of your mouth saying that you're for women, but yet you're doing things that harm women on all of these fronts.
Absolutely. So if we go back just for a second, you said we need to do things to prevent these circumstances in which women get abortions. And what would you recommend? What do you think would be the best solution for these issues?
Yeah. You know, we have a lot of organizations out there that are willing to help women. And this does not have to be something that the federal government does. The federal government just needs to get out of the way and let these organizations do their work. And so, you know, we want to do, how about if we took some of that money that we're using to fund abortions, to fund Planned Parenthood, which never even ask a woman if she's been trafficked, even though we know that women that have been trafficked tend to have multiple abortions, and they're having them at Planned Parenthood most of the time. But Planned Parenthood isn't asking things like, hey, this gentleman here who's 10, 15 years your senior, and asking in private, Is this person harming you? Are they trafficking you when this person is a young girl? You know, we know that people that are trafficked, the average age of being trafficked is 9 to 12 years old. And they have a life expectancy of about 7 years. So these are children we're talking about. And Planned Parenthood isn't addressing this issue with them. Even asking, who is this person that's brought you in? What's the relationship? What's the nature of this relationship? How did you meet them? And those are legitimate questions that you should be asking a young person that's coming in pregnant, right? And so, you know, that's one thing we can do is stop funding these agencies that are, and really it is, at this point, an arm of the government. because they get so much federal funding. And so we need to stop funding them. We need to provide organizations that actually are there to help women. You know, here in our area, we have Centers of Hope. You know, we have Oregon Right to Life. There's all kinds of agencies that are there to help women find an alternative solution and that can walk with them in life and help them to find, you know, a safe place to live. Help them do some job training so that way they, you know, are able to support their families, help them find childcare, you know, help if they wanted to go ahead and take the pregnancy to conclusion and then allow the child to be adopted out to someone. You know, they can help them do those things and get their life back on track. And that does not have to touch the federal government. The federal government should not be involved in those things. We have a lot of religious organizations or just nonprofits that are out there well ready and willing to do a lot of this work. We just need to get out of their way and let them do it.
Which is a prime example of why issues such as this, such as Roe v. Wade, should have never gone to the federal government, should have been let the states, been left up to the states, because they're the ones best suited to figure this out. Because the federal government's got a million other things to do. How can it possibly wrap its mind around each 50 state and their needs?
Exactly. But,
which is out of this decision, if it comes out the same way that we have it leaked, and it's unfortunate that it got leaked, but it's an encouraging sign that the federal government is starting to rein itself in, which does not happen very often. So you have to take it when you have to take those victories when they come. Mm-hmm. So speaking about reining in the government, mm-hmm. we have seen the Biden administration and most recently the Attorney General call concerned parents domestic terrorists for attending school board meetings mm-hmm. and openly voicing their concerns about their child's education. Now, the Biden administration would have you believe that the child in question is not the parents, but it's the government basically owns them and they can teach them what they see fit. So reining in the federal government at this mm-hmm. at this place, what would you in Congress suggest?
So, you know, there's a lot of rules at the federal level through the Department of Education. We need to scale that back significantly. The Department of Education has really overstepped and done a lot that really it doesn't have the right to do. So again, you know, education needs to be done at the state level. That's not something that really should, the curriculum should not be getting dictated from the federal government. But what we could do is tie federal monies to things that should not be taught. So we should not be teaching children to hate our nation in our public schools. So taxpayers should not be paying for children to learn to hate our nation. So we need to get politics out of the classroom, first of all. The only thing they should be learning in politics is how our government works and learning critical thought so they can make their own decisions about those kinds of things, not being ideologically indoctrinated into believing one thing or another. You know, I remember when I was in school, when it came to topics that were controversial, our teachers would have us write an essay on what our beliefs were and have us support them. And so, you know, they were teaching us how to think critically about what we believed. And they weren't trying to persuade us one way or another. They were allowing us to decide what we believed, but they wanted us to think through it and talk about it and be able to write about it in a comprehensive way. But right now we have 50% of our third graders that can't even read. And we have 40 to 50% of our graduating high schoolers that have to take remedial courses just to go take 100 level college courses. So how are they going to write a paper and demonstrate critical thinking skills? They can't. And so we're seeing this intentional dumbing down of our nation. And, you know, here we've done away with standards for graduation, you know, instead of trying to promote educational excellence that's going to help our kids to get out of things like poverty, where they can go on and then compete at the state level, the federal level, the international level with other people their age, or in the workforce, we're taking all of those standards away and preventing our kids from actually growing and flourishing and prospering.
Absolutely. It was not too long ago, just to date myself, that I was back in school, and we did pretty much the same thing. Thank the Lord that our teachers allowed us to have our own thoughts, then shape them, and then, okay, well, this is what actually happened. We don't have that anymore. We have, this is actually what happened, and if you think like this or don't think like this, then you're all of the ists, racist, homophobic, xenophobic, which is, again, you sacrifice a child's education on the altar of ideology, and you get things like this. And people are stunned to find that Oregon schools, for example, aren't the best compared to other states in the union, and nationally as well. The U.S. is not where it could be at all.
Yeah.
So yes, it should be reined back to the state level.
Yeah, absolutely needs to be brought back to the state's level. And I think we need to tie federal funding to schools on what, not necessarily on what they can teach, but what they can't teach.
Right. And what would you say to someone, to a parent who was fed up with public education and put their child into a private school?
Yep. Happened to me. So my kid was getting bullied. Other kids were getting bullied. School wasn't doing anything about it. We tried to do in-district transfers. They wouldn't allow it. Both of my boys in third grade couldn't read. So we had to hire outside tutoring. And so at that point we realized that we were paying private school prices. So we pulled our one child for safety reasons, actually, and put him in private school. Within the first term, he was an AB student. It has everything to do with the environment, and which are extremely unsafe right now, our schools, because they've taken out the SROs and they've allowed bullying and violence to just flourish in the schools. Kids are not safe. How can you learn in an environment where you're physically not safe? Not to mention all the emotional stuff that's happening in schools because of everything they're being taught, which is against the will of their parents. And it's oftentimes not even with the knowledge of their parents. And so, I think we absolutely need to make sure we have school choice and that the money's following the child.
Absolutely. So winding down here, while we're talking about the effects of the public school system and children, we've seen the devastating effects that COVID lockdowns have had on our children. What do you propose that can be done to ensure that those kinds of things never happen again?
You know, I would love to see us have an amendment in our Constitution that explicitly describes medical choice as belonging to the individual and not to the state or to the federal government. There was talk about that amongst our founding fathers, and they ended up not putting it in there. And it would have been much better if they had, but they didn't. And so, you know, we kind of have a choice as to whether or not we're going to do that now, or are we going to, you know, try and pass some laws that prohibit that at the federal level? And, you know, barring making a change to our Constitution, I think that's what we're going to need to do.
Absolutely. And as we're winding down here, I want to say thank you for the opportunity for the conversation. I know that I've been trying to get you on the show for the longest of time, and campaign season, it happens. So I'd like to thank you for making time for this interview today.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I would love after the primary to have you back. We can talk more about the general.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So
be happy to do it.
Thank you for all of you listening. I will link her social media and all her webs and her website in the link of this episode. I will provide you with the episode, so no worries, you will have everything for the campaign. Look forward to hearing more great news from your campaign. Enjoy your event today, and I wish you the best of luck in your primary.
All right, thank you, David.
All right, thank you very much. You enjoy your event.
Okay, bye-bye.